Welcome to Teamwork, A Better Way, the podcast filled with stories, experiences, and insights from leading high-performing team experts. Here are your hosts, Spencer Horn and Christian Napier.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Teamwork, A Better Way. I'm Christian Napier, and that illustrious man there in the purple, is that purple?
It is purple, Spencer, yeah. Horn.
Spencer, how you doing? Welcome back.
I am fantastic. My nose is a little sounding a little bothersome, but I've been on the road since February 22nd, and I am so happy to be home. So happy.
Well, most recently you were at the National Speakers Association Thrive Conference. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and as we talk with our host, who was an integral part of this conference and one of the closing speakers that brought the house down. We're so excited to have her. It was a great, great conference. Usually about 300 people. And these are, Christian, you've been to Winter Conference before. It's typically more of the serious speakers. A lot of times at Influence, which is an incredible event, but a lot of them are newer. But I was surprised at just everybody, how engaged they were. It's just such a great conference, and it was incredible content.
Well, that's fantastic. Where was it held this year, Spencer?
Albuquerque this year. So we didn't get to see much because we were so literally lunchtime, breakfast, everything was constantly full of actionable content for entrepreneurs and thought leaders and speakers, podcasters, coaches, and anybody who really uses the spoken word for their livelihood, this is the place to be. And people were from all over the world. So that was an absolutely incredible weekend.
Well, that's awesome. My wife and I, we love Albuquerque, the Sandia Mountains there in the back. And then, you know, it's about an hour drive to Santa Fe. It's one of our favorite places to go. So fantastic. Welcome back home. And you've already hinted at who our guest might be, and I'm really excited for you to introduce her, Spencer.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to put her on the screen while I talk about her. This is Meredith Elliott Powell. And, you know, when she starts her bio by saying she's a researcher, I think that is really, really important because what she researches is so vital to business success today and leaders' success and what they can deal with the problems that are so relevant today. And so she starts with that, and it may sound a little boring, but it is so important because of what she's able to bring out and quickly solve in terms of problems that are relevant. She's an award-winning author. She's a Hall of Fame speaker. Hall of Fame. So that is... Meredith, I don't even know, like 0.001% of all speakers get that appellation. But she's the CEO of Motion First, and it's an innovation company designed to help organizations and professionals and entrepreneurs turn uncertainty to competitive advantage. Now, that gets to be underlined. She is the developer of the Thrive System, a highly researched, proven methodology that solves the biggest problems facing businesses today and how to succeed in the face of highly shifting, highly uncertain marketplaces. And her work has sparked a movement, a belief that you can control the changes coming in the marketplace. I don't know that everyone believes that. But that is pretty amazing. And that even the most challenging disruption can lead to unprecedented growth. Well, that's not enough. I mean, she's like a top 15 business growth expert to watch. She's one of the top 41 motivational speakers in the entire world. She has a top 50 blog. She's an award-winning author, as I mentioned. But not only that, she is an invitation-only trainer, thought leader on LinkedIn. And she has a huge following there because she is somebody that is incredibly relevant. And lastly, I'd like to say, as one of the closing speakers at the Thrive Conference, she absolutely lit the room on fire. And I'm not going to say everything that, or really anything about what she talked about, other than she is talking to a group of 300 speakers. And to get them to feel emotional, I felt emotional, to connect with them at an emotional level, it's not an easy thing to do, is it, Meredith?
No, you know, it was funny. Somebody asked me, they said, what is it like to talk to a room full of speakers? And I said, it is kind of the most passive aggressive experience you'll ever have, because you know they're going to give you a standing ovation. But if you're not good, they're going to be the ones that come after you too. So it's but honestly, it's an honor. Oh my gosh. I mean, I love our community. The National Speakers Association is phenomenal. What we do for each other, what we do for the industry, and what we do to help our clients is just really amazing.
And that's something that you have been doing for many, many years through the Speakers Association. What I didn't mention is you're also the chairman of the board of the National Speakers Association. And I know those who are listeners may not be NSA members. To run an organization like this for many years and for it to be successful the way it is takes a lot of energy and a lot of effort. And you've been a vice chair for several years. You've been on the board for several years, and now you are steering the ship. And you have been integrally involved in making sure that we as speakers and those in the speaking community have the resources that they need. And so you have been so generous, not only to all speakers, but to us coming on our show. So thank you.
I'm excited to be here. I'm just honored that you would ask me.
Well, thank you. So I want to start off for people who don't know you. This world of uncertainty, I mean, we obviously we live in a VUCA world. We talk about that all the time. It's volatile, uncertain, chaotic, ambiguous. And for some people, that just locks them up in terms of how do we prepare? How do we plan? How do we behave? But before we get into that, how did you even get into this space and focusing on uncertainty? That some people say you're so lucky to have done that.
Yeah, so there's kind of two stories that merge together. I honestly think that I was born for this work. And the reason is, I don't know, about a year ago, I was doing a podcast and somebody said, tell us about your past. Tell us about your career path. And I thought, oh goodness, my career path doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, I started out in travel and tourism, then I got into healthcare, then I got into financial services, all before I became a speaker and an entrepreneur. And I never thought that my career path made any sense until I was on that podcast and I realized I got into travel and tourism when they had just experienced a hurricane and the community was completely wiped out. I got into healthcare when managed care was kind of ravaging the industry. And I got into financial services when regulation and heavy competition and spiking interest rates were shifting the industry dramatically. And I figured out that when uncertainty hits, most people pull back, and that's when I run in. That's when I get turned on. So I feel like I was always kind of born to do the work. But then I really kind of named it uncertainty because I've just started listening to my clients. I mean, I think anybody who owns a business ought to decide what they offer in the marketplace needs to be positioned in a way that solves problems for your customers, because that's really why you're in business, right? Is to help people. And in 2016 and 17, long before all this uncertainty hit, I was talking to customers, I was talking to clients, just asking questions. How's business? How's life? How are things going? What are you worried about? Where do you see opportunity? And I found this through line. Everybody was saying the same thing. We're having our best year on record. Things couldn't be more explosive in the business. It's exciting, but oh, this uncertainty. And the through line taught me in listening to them that people position uncertainty as a bad thing. They see it as a negative. They believe it is going to disrupt growth rather than propel it. And I just thought, I need to help people solve that problem. And that was how I landed there. And then when I connected with the fact that it's my passion, it's just been the perfect storm.
Well, that is, it's interesting. You talked about the hurricane in the travel industry. I don't think I've ever shared this with you, Christian, but I worked with a company that developed tourist entertainment centers with IMAX theaters in tourist destinations. And we had our first one in Branson, but our second one was to be built in St. Thomas. And this was 1996. And we had this was a publicly traded company. We had a public offering to raise money for the second theater. This is where the cruise ships would all come in and we'd have this cultural center. And the hurricane destroyed the island in 1996. And so all the services that were to be used for us to build our facility went to rebuilding just basic infrastructure. And so we talk about uncertainty and the offering failed. And I went to the CEO and I said, should I be looking for another job? This is Kelvin, my mentor that Christian and I talk about all the time. He says, yeah, it's probably a good idea. So uncertainty sometimes can make a difference. But for me, it ended up being incredible for my career. So how do you leverage that challenge and those experiences to move you forward? Well, let's talk about that. So our theme today is really how to create a future-focused workforce that embraces changes and uncertainty as an opportunity, as you've just introduced. Yet before we get to that, you know, what are the steps? What are the problems of creating that workforce? Because this is a team-focused podcast. What are the problems that you see? So, you know, your CEOs are telling you this problem. Do they have a problem? Do their teams have a problem? What are they? What have you seen?
Yeah. So, you know, what's so interesting is when COVID hit, we all thought that that was uncertainty. And ever since we have moved past COVID, uncertainty has gone on steroids. And the biggest challenge that I get from leaders today is saying, my team is overwhelmed. They are burned out. They are exhausted from the last couple of years. Yet the change in front of us is moving so much faster, and I've got to get them on board. And it is as if I see with leaders today, their teams are fighting them because they're exhausted. And I think part of it is we're using leadership strategies that are meant for a different time and a different marketplace. And you know, Spencer, you said it so well. Leaders do have a problem. You have to realize if people are not following you, then you're the problem. Now, here's the beauty. That sounds so negative. It isn't negative. I love knowing I'm the problem, because when I know I'm the problem, I can fix me, right? So yeah, that's definitely where it needs to start. It is a valid complaint. The reason that employees are struggling with change is valid. It is understandable why you are exhausted. It is understandable why you are fried. It is understandable why you do not want any more change. But the problem is, you got to keep going. So we have to create an environment that gets that team future focused.
So Christian, I can't not say something, and he's used to me cutting off, but I see that all the time. Meredith, is that CEOs are saying, well, I've got this person who's a problem on my team, and I need them to get this, and I'm like, okay, before we talk about them, is it possible that part of the problem is that you're part of the problem? And if you're going to get them to want to change, you've got to be able to build that trust. And you're absolutely right. It's outdated leadership styles. And most of us, I mean, my age, Meredith, you're, I know, in your 30s, but, you know, my generation was taught by the greatest generation and, you know, or the baby boomers who learned from the greatest generation. It was a lot of command and control. And, but the leadership style absolutely has to change. I yield, Christian.
Wow. Okay. Well, one thing I want to ask, you talked about this through line, Meredith, that you've seen through your career, where all of these inflection points pivoted around areas of uncertainty, and that certainly carried you through COVID and what happened with National Speakers Association, because if there's any group that that could be impacted by not having events, it would be speakers who don't have any events to speak at anymore. And I'm curious how you took the lessons that you've learned throughout that and applied them in that specific organization, not to mention your own organization, to help them overcome this adversity, this uncertainty, and actually put themselves in a stronger situation to embrace the future.
Oh, I love that question, because, you know, I really thought that I had mastered so much of this. I really thought I was kind of at the pinnacle of understanding how you lead through uncertainty. And then these last couple of years with the National Speakers Association have taught me so much more about how much power and how much control you have in the face of uncertainty. You know, with the National Speakers Association and with my own business, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about speakers is that when COVID hit, we were in the same bucket as everybody else, is that we didn't know what we were going to do. but we took it a little harder on the chin because not only was our business disrupted, we lost our business model. I mean, I could no longer get on planes. I could no longer engage with people. I could no longer travel around the world. And that was how I made a living. So I didn't, my revenue not only disappeared, but I couldn't revive my business model. And then the same thing kind of happened with the National Speakers Association. We had lost some runway with some things that had happened with the association after the last 10 years, and our business model was no longer relevant and we could no longer move forward with it. And the biggest lesson that I have learned from with both of those is that there is so much power in being able to focus on what you can control. And that sounds so trite, but one of the things that I do with my clients when I work on the Thrive System is that I say, put down everything you're worried about, everything that you are scared about, everything that is keeping you up at night, everything that you think could disrupt or cause, pain to your business or your organization. Write it all down. And the reason I want people to get it out is because I don't believe you can move past things until you get them out of your system. And then once you get them out of your system, let's write down what you can control. And when you write down what you can control, which is usually no more than three or four things, there is so much power in keeping your focus there. That what the mind is able to find based on what you feed it is amazing. And that is really where the path through uncertainty begins. And so I would say that the biggest lesson that I have learned that I practice in my business today, even though for me, the economy is healthy, business is good, things are good, I still have really, very much focused on the things I can control, dealing with customers, being good at what I do, making my sales calls, managing my business, building an effective team around me. And I think one of the things in keeping with the theme of your show, there's so little that leaders can control in today's marketplace, but the most important thing that they can control is the one thing they have control over, and that is the quality of the people that they surround themselves with. And leaders need to not delegate that to HR. The talent they have on their team, that is their job, because the stronger people you have around you, you can get through anything.
Well, it is not an HR. They're there to support and help. You're exactly right. And the CEO, I mean, my mentor would always say, I'd rather have people on my team that are so much smarter than me.
Yes.
But it takes a special individual to be able to manage that environment that creates and to attract those type of people that want to be there and that have the ability to shine. And that means letting go of some of the power and authority that comes a lot of times with entrepreneurs and business leaders. So that creates an interesting problem, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that probably, I do a lot of succession planning in companies. Yeah. And one of the biggest obstacles to succession planning is people fear training somebody to do what they do because they worry they're going to put themselves out of a job. And the truth is, years ago, I was getting ready to do a job interview in Charlotte, North Carolina. I was waiting on the CEO to interview me. And there was an article magazine there. It was John Chambers. He was head of Cisco at the time. And what the article was about was the incredible team John Chambers built around himself. And they interviewed all these people that worked directly in the C-suite for John Chambers. And what they all said was, we are the CEOs of our own company, but this is an incredible culture because we get to work together. And John leads through the power of the question. He surrounds himself through really smart people and lets you run things. His job is to bring it together. And you got to realize as a leader today, if you can build a team around you that is engaged, that is smart, that is capable, you win. Period. You win. When it is the highest and best use of your time, pray that you are the weakest link on the team.
Boy, I hope some of those CEOs can hear that. Be the weakest link on the team. But it's so true. And the engagement part really comes from having that ownership.
Yeah.
And that goes all the way throughout the organization. Sure. Some people say, well, what if I create all this organization of leaders? That creates, there's a misunderstanding of what it means to lead. That's you're serving up, you're serving down. and that's difficult. So what do you see just with this rapid change that's happening in the marketplace? You mentioned one misconception that CEOs have about uncertainty, and that it's bad. Are there any others that are misconceptions about uncertainty that you think that there are myths that need to be debunked?
Yeah. I would say, absolutely. Number one is that it's negative. Number two is that they need to go into command and control. When uncertainty hits, it is a time to let go and to engage the team. I would say another misconception around uncertainty is that either I see a lot of CEOs think they can't develop a strategy when the marketplace is so uncertain, or the CEO develops a strategy that is so rigid they don't make it as flexible as they need to make it. I would say another misconception is that the sales process gets so aggressive and so company centric that it forgets about the customer, and you don't really understand what it takes to grow in an uncertain marketplace. The last, I don't know if it's a misconception, but I'd call it a mistake, is another mistake I see in the marketplace is you double down and you do strategies and steps and behaviors that you've always done, whether they're effective or not. There's no measurement of whether what you're doing is truly moving the organization forward, benefiting the team or not. And then I would say the last misconception is you can't be successful. It is your best time ever. I think you should want an uncertain marketplace. And the reason I say that is because when uncertainty hits, your customers need you more than they have ever needed you before. You are desired in the marketplace. The second is your competitors will pull back because most people shut down in an uncertain marketplace, creating more opportunity, more opportunity for growth. So those are just some of my thoughts around it.
Well, a question I have with uncertainty, Meredith, is organizations spend a lot of money to reduce uncertainty through technology. You know, we try to capture as much data as granularly as possible these days, right? So when it comes to marketing, are the messages that we're getting out, are they resonating with people, and are they actually reaching the right people? And we spend a fair amount of money trying to figure out answers to these questions. And so organizations, to kind of overcome the perceived obstacles of uncertainty, will spend a lot of capital trying to get as much data as they possibly can so that they can make informed decisions. But I'm curious, from your perspective, where do you draw the line? Because you could spend so much time and effort trying to understand every little aspect of the market that you end up not making decisions because you don't have the information, you're not comfortable. So as a leader, how do you say, okay, well, we need to capture more data so I can make an informed decision, and weigh that against, well, I need to go with my gut and I need to embrace this uncertainty? How do you figure that balance out?
Yeah, it's interesting. The data is a great thing. I love data. And I think the more that you can know and understand about the marketplace does help you make informed decisions. But we are living in a time now when there is more happening outside of your organization than inside it that can impact your ability to be successful. So you have to be able to make decisions in the gray. And this is not about perfection. Here's the beautiful thing about anticipation. Is your job as a leader is to keep your team moving, because when they're moving, they have more ability to be flexible. So imagine if I said, the three of us are going to run a race, and we all sat down and drank coffee, and then somebody fired a gun and we had to get up and run, versus if we were walking around a track and somebody fired a gun and said, run, we would get running. We would start moving faster. That's your job as a leader. So the strategy that we use in our Thrive system is called conditioning yourself for change, conditioning your team for change. And what that means is you got to get them in shape for change, right? You got to get them thinking constantly that the marketplace is going to shift and change so that when it shifts and change, they're ready to move. We use a tool for this called a skeptic. It's just, I ask my clients every quarter, walk your team through the skeptic tool. And the skeptic tool is nothing more than a series of questions. Gather people together at a team meeting, take 20 minutes and say, hey guys, what do you see happening with society? What's happening with competition? How's our industry changing? What's going on with our customers? And getting the team talking about change gets them to start anticipating change. And even if you don't guess it right, when the change happens, they'll be ready to move. I'll give you a really quick example. I was working with a financial institution. You want to talk about an industry that is going through change. They got no idea what is coming at them. I mean, if the Democrats win the election, they're going to have so much regulation coming at them. If Republicans win, it won't be as much. But if one more bank goes down, oh my gosh, what's going to happen with interest rates? I mean, they're so in the air. They don't have a clue. So what we're doing is talking about these changes coming in the marketplace. What do we see? What do we need to be doing now to get ready if any of these things happen? Well, as we were going through this exercise, one of our team members brought up the fact, he said, you know, I think one of our major competitors, there's rumor on the street, they're going to go through a merger. They're going to be bought by another financial institution. So we moved our prospect list. We saw this happening. It didn't happen for another 8 months. But we had already started calling on those clients because, you know, anytime a merger happens, the company messes it up and it's the worst customer experience of your life. But we were able to capitalize, take something that would be perceived as a threat because this financial institution was going to be far larger with far bigger power and could squish us like a bug. But we got in there before things changed. And what I want to emphasize is the leader didn't tell the team to do that. They're walking the team through the exercise. So that was a really long-winded answer to what you asked, but this is not about perfection. Gather the data, but keep the team moving. And if the team is moving, when opportunity arises, they'll be able to change directions so fast and capitalize on it. And they'll do it with ease because they're in shape.
I love that idea of getting in shape. It's just, you're normalizing every, yes. Logically, we all believe that there's change and we understand that cognitively, but still we're not taking those opportunities to really focus on it as an exercise internally is what I hear you
right.
saying. So we're normalizing that activity, which gives people the opportunity to actually name the fear.
Yes.
That they may have. And when you name that fear, it has less power and control over you, which is something you can do, right? You talked about do what you can do and naming that. And then you can start to brainstorm again, focus on more things that you can do. When COVID hit, just before COVID hit, Christian and I started this podcast. We had a different theme. And then like 2 weeks later, we'd recorded, I don't know, two or three sessions, Christian. They've never gone public. But we learned so much. We shifted the focus of this. But one of the things I did as a speaker, Meredith, is everybody had time.
Yeah.
And I had just hired someone to help me on LinkedIn, somebody I've known for years in Las Vegas. She's Christian, you know her. She's fantastic. And she had a team of people that were generating conversations and calls. I had 25 calls a week. It takes a lot to get that. And I was having incredible conversations, just talking to people about what you were saying. What's going on? What are the problems? Not selling, just talking. And I got so much business from that. There are clients that I still have today because people were available. And just having conversations just kept me busy instead of awfulizing and catastrophizing. I was focusing on something, as you said earlier, moving forward. And there's so much power in moving forward. So I'm just wanting to validate what you say because and I love this case study that you shared, but for a leader to do what the leader did in that case, I want to know what are the, you talked about outdated leadership styles and approaches. What did that leader do differently? What are the characteristics that that leader needed to have in order for that environment to exist that they were able to take advantage?
Yeah. You know, I would say number one is that they didn't believe that change was driven top down. And that's probably the biggest and the most important. You know, one of the reasons our teams fight change, if you really think about it, you empathize with it. I was speaking at a conference last week, and I said to the leaders in this room, I was talking about the skeptic tool. I said, everybody who works for you right now is sitting back in their office thinking, they're going to come back from this conference, and what are they going to do to me? You know, what kind of change are they going to push on me? And so that leader understood that change is far more effective if it is driven bottom up. And so he understood that. I would also say he created an environment where he trusted that his team wouldn't fight change. They would participate in change. He was also open to ideas and to listening, that things didn't have to come from him, that opportunity, could come from his team, and he empowered them. So he was, a characteristic would be that he was able to take the back seat. And then the last piece I would say is that he took action on it. He grabbed that idea and said, brilliant. Now let's build the framework around that. Let's take the opportunity with it. So it's, you know, it is leading in, I mean, I definitely want to say he was a leader, but he led in a way that was inclusive and engaged and empowered the team and trusted them enough to say, come up with the ideas. If your team is fighting change right now, and most teams are, I'm going to guarantee you it is because you are driving it top down. And they're not bad people for fighting it. Nobody likes change if it is put upon them. They want to participate in it. And if you let them participate in it, they'll change faster and further than any thought of change you ever had in your head.
I'm absolutely loving this conversation, Meredith. And one thing that I'm getting from what you are telling me is that fundamentally, the way that you take advantage of uncertainty is to build your own certainty. One, by hiring the right people so you that are amenable to it. And then two, it's skilling them up so that they understand when an uncertain event happens, they have the toolkit, they've got the machinery in place to actually take advantage of it at that particular time. I'm wondering, in your experience, how difficult or easy is it for leaders to find the right people? You know, I have spent most of my career in this major event space, and I have interviewed about 1,500 people in this space. And I find that in these major events, which are very, very high pressure, you know, Olympic Games or World Cups are very high pressure events, that people who are A, intellectually curious, B, are attracted to solving problems, not put off by it, and C, have a mindset that no job is too small and we got to get it done because the show must go on, will have a higher success rate in this environment than others who do not. But when we're recruiting people, that's never on the job description.
That's right.
It's you have to have 5 years of this and 10 years of that and very technical skills at times. And so my thought is, as a leader, how do you get your HR folks to align with what you really need? Because oftentimes they're writing these job descriptions that really, at the end of the day, they don't matter, you know, because what you want are these people who are going to be resilient and they'll be able to step up and actually welcome and embrace these opportunities. When something comes that's outside of their comfort zone, you want the kind of person that says, oh yeah, you know, I'm curious to take that on. Yeah. So how do you go about finding these people?
Yeah. I love and agree with everything you're saying. It completely cracks me up that when I ask people who are the stars on their team, they list all these incredible characteristics, yet they put together a job description that doesn't label any of those, doesn't put it out there. That's not at all what they're hiring for. So again, talk about some outdated practices. So there's a lot that we do around this. Number one, I think human resources has become a sales function. They need to operate exactly like your sales team operates. And this is how your sales team operates. Number one, the sales team creates a target market. In HR, I call it an avatar. You need to take the top 10 people in your company, write their names down, and design your avatar. This is the person most likely to be successful in your company. And to your point, it will have nothing to do with how much experience they have, what degree they got in college, or what, you know, title they hold. It has nothing to do with that. It is self-starter. They're resilient. They have a great attitude, all those types of things. Build your avatar. I make my clients name that avatar. I want to be really clear on who we're looking for. And then just so you know, when you name that avatar, that person already has a job because they're a hard worker with a work ethic. They're not going to be home and on their parents' couch. So your HR team needs to be nurturing them away, just like you nurture them from, you know, in sales. Any really good customer you get was a customer of somebody else. But don't do any of that until you get your culture right. Now, I know you guys are the kings of creating the right culture. But again, I wouldn't attract a new customer if my experience was weak, if I didn't have good customer service or a good product. I would fix all of that first, because when I bring somebody into the walls of my company, I want them to stay. So it really needs to become, I always say, take off the HR hat, get somebody to do compliance. You know, somebody's got to be doing what traditional HR work is doing. Now, your sales team and your HR team, their strategies need to be the same, and you need to be proactive in this arena and really go after those people.
Well, I'm hoping we have some HR folks on the line. I'd love to hear from them what they feel about that. And with this avatar, I'd like you to say a little bit more about that. Meredith, I had an experience working with the sales team at Merrill Lynch, and we did exactly that. I mean, one of the things I said is I want to talk to your top performers. And we interviewed and assessed their top 8 performers. And in terms of personality, they were all across the board. So there was not one style of behavior that determined their success. So I'm curious, what does an avatar look like? Is it, you know, is it personality? Is it, you know, is it experience? Is it traits? What have you found something that some people have that je ne sais quoi that really makes that difference?
Yeah, well, it's different. It's different for every company, right? I just built an avatar for a company. It's different for every company. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, if we were all going to go out and find, you know, spouses, we wouldn't find the same spouse. What works in your life works different in my life. You know, it's different. So, but I just built an avatar for a healthcare company that is, you know, growing like crazy. And we've got to find the right fit. And what we found is that they've recruited a lot of people that didn't make it, and they've recruited a lot of people that did. And a couple of things are, there's an age range. They're family, very family oriented. They're athletic and competed in some type of sports in high school or college.
Defeat.
Yeah, exactly. And typically they have been a leader on a team, and they, you know, they have responsibilities in life now, you know, with a family and those type of things. They typically are, have gotten some kind of award in their past for, you know, being, you know, the most supportive on their team or having a really great attitude or things. But those were the things that we were looking in. And now we've framed our questions in an interview to kind of ask about that. You know, tell us about your college experience. You know, what did you participate in? How was that for you? Those types of things. And trying to get a feel. It's not perfect, but it's better. But here's the beautiful thing. Here's where the power is. Once we defined the avatar and you give the avatar to everybody in your company that is that avatar, they know who they are. And they recognize, it's like radar. They recognize another one of them. And we have them looking for themselves out in the community and bringing themselves in to the company.
Well, I want to get to this 9-step program, but I have so many questions. Christian, don't you?
Oh, well, yeah, we could go on for hours.
I know we don't want to run out of time, but she's so busy. But I'd like to ask at least one more before we get to that. You talked about one of the challenges of that a team faces in being future focused and focusing on change, and that is exhaustion.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's part of your 9 steps. If it is, then I'll relegate it to that. But is there something that you can do? Because here's what I see. Okay, you do a strategic plan, for example. That's all about future. This is what we're going to implement. We've done our research. These are the problems. These are what we're going to change. And everybody looks at that and goes, oh, no, I've got to do that on top of everything else that I have to do that I'm already burned out about.
Yeah, exactly. So it is sort of my 9 step, but I'm going to go ahead and frame it because I think it's such an important question. There's a couple of things that that need to be done. People get exhausted because they do not feel like what they are doing is accomplishing anything. And the first step in the Thriving in Uncertainty formula is the importance for the leader to have a vision. And I call it a relentless vision. It means it is a vision that you are so focused on that the mind will find a way to get there. And the importance for a team is this is so interesting. 2% of our population is visionary. 12% are strategic thinkers. And the rest of us, we are only tactical. We can only see what is right in front of us. It's why uncertainty is so difficult, because all we can see are the obstacles. But if you as a leader cast a vision and you talk about that vision constantly, you show people what is possible. And when you show people what is possible, that builds energy. You know, the best example, and I talk about this sometimes from the stage, is Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And I have no idea what it was like to fight for civil rights, but I can take a guess. I imagine it was a step forward, 12 steps back. And people wanted to give up because they didn't know it could be accomplished. The price was too high. And why should they keep going when they didn't even know if what they were doing was possible? That's the exhaustion. But what Martin Luther King Jr. did with that speech was showed people what was possible, showed them if they kept going, what they could do. That infuses people with energy. For those of us who can't see a vision, a leader has to cast that vision and has to consistently talk about that vision and show people why what they are doing is moving them and the organization forward. The other piece is strategy number 8. It's shed fast and keep moving. And while conditioning yourself for change gets you to look forward and anticipate change, exhaustion comes from doing stuff that doesn't matter. You know, we call it shed fast and keep moving. In a world where there is more happening externally, you have to understand that some of the things that you're doing right now, they're not going to work 3 months from now. And they're not going to work because you're bad or because you're wrong. They're not going to work because the marketplace shifted. And so your job as a leader is to help people understand what's productive and understand what is busy. And if your people are exhausted, they are far too focused on busy and they are not focused on productive. And the shed fast, keep moving tool helps them understand the difference. But you got to clean that house out like you clean your car consistently. Get the junk out of there because it builds up. And that's why they're getting exhausted.
All right, well, Meredith, let's get into those 9 steps. So, you know, step 0 is getting the right people. But once you've got the right people on board, you've got to skill them up and you've got to put a framework in place so that they can actually take advantage of the uncertainty that surrounds us. So, yeah, walk us through those 9 steps. And I'm sorry, gosh, we've been going for 45 minutes. It feels like it's been about 10. But,
good news is we've covered some of them. Number 1 is the foundational piece, and that's the relentless vision. You have got to be clear on where you're headed, and you have got to paint that picture for your team. That gives them a sense of purpose. It gives them something to align to. It gives them something to feel a sense of team. If I'm not walking through your organization, if I can't walk up to anybody and say, where are we going to be a year from now, then you're not casting a relentless vision. Number two is condition yourself for change. That's where we use the skeptic tool. I love this step because I learned it. I learned a lot about it from the U.S. military. And the U.S. military has a great phrase called embrace the suck. And I love that because I don't think you should run from the uncertainty in the marketplace. You should embrace it. The idea behind it is that it isn't the optimist. It isn't the one who goes, I'm just not participating in this recession. And it isn't the pessimist that thrives in uncertainty. It is the realist, the one who says, you know what, this sucks, but how can we use it to propel our organization forward? And that's where you get the team to talk about the change. You get the team to talk about the new technology or the competition coming in. And how can we use it not to prevent us from growing, but now that we have time to think about it, how can we use it to propel the growth forward? Number three is competition becomes collaboration. I love this strategy. And think about how many organizations and how many teams are working in silos. And the idea is that when uncertainty hits, the team doesn't say, what are we going to do about the uncertainty? The team says, who do we need to be working with? Who has already solved this problem or is working on this problem that we could learn from? And the idea around it is that it isn't that that you can't solve your own problems, because you can. But everything in uncertainty is about saving time, energy, and resources. And if somebody is already working on the problem or can help you with the problem, learn from them. I'll give you a quick example. When COVID hit, I had a client who was selling in the restaurant industry. They were a technology company. Well, you can imagine, like me, they were decimated. Restaurants weren't buying at all. And then I had a healthcare company that was growing like a weed, but they had never sold virtually. Both of them called me for help. Now, I could have taken the business. I could have helped my healthcare company sell virtually, and I could have helped my technology company break into a new market. But instead, I backed out and I connected the two together. And I told my healthcare company, I said, this team has been selling virtually since they started in 1990s. I'm going to tell them to show you how to sell virtually, how to build a virtual sales team. And I told my healthcare company, this team has got to figure out how to get into markets that are lucrative, and healthcare is lucrative. I want you to open doors for them so their technology can work in these markets. Boom. Competition becomes collaboration, and they learn from one another. Strategy number four, I love strategy number four, is because the toughest thing that you've got to do, and this is so much what you all have asked me about today, is how do you make decisions when you have no idea what the marketplace is going to hold? Do you grow? Do you pull back? Do you add team members? Do you invest in technology? Do you open a new market? Should you hire a team? Should you lay people off? You don't know what's going to happen in the marketplace. Every single company that I interviewed, every single one, made decisions exactly the same way. And they made decisions according to their core values. They were clear on who they were and what they stood for. And they used their core values like a litmus test. If it aligned with their core values, it was the right decision for them. If it didn't align with their core values, they let it go. But here's the trick to that, is you can't use your core values for some decisions and not for other decisions. You have to use your core values for every single decision that you make. If you have a leader in place who doesn't align with your core values, you've broken the system. You got to use it for everything. Probably the greatest example of this today is Chick-fil-A. I mean, there is a company that stands for their core values. You may agree with them, you may not, it doesn't matter. But when the media took Chick-fil-A to task for their core values, do you know what happened? Line went around the building at Chick-fil-A. And the reason line went around the building at Chick-fil-A is because customers find you. The other thing, you want to talk about the only organization not struggling to find help today? Chick-fil-A. Because people know what they stand for. And people who align with you will come with you. And people who don't like you will stay away. Strategy number five. I love strategy number five because strategy number five is all about how you make money in the face of uncertainty. And as I told you before, it is the best time to make money because your customers need you now more than ever and your competitors will evaporate. But you have to understand that how you make money is very different in an uncertain marketplace than how you make it in a certain marketplace. You need to grow from the inside out. You are not selling a product or service. You are selling the solution to a problem. I got to quickly tell you my favorite story, and then I'll rip through these last strategies and let you guys ask me your final questions. But I learned this strategy from Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble was started in the 1800s by two men, Mr. Procter and Mr. Gamble, who had competing businesses, and they were marrying sisters. And one night at the dining room table in Cincinnati, Ohio, their future father-in-law heard them fighting about a product that they both needed to make their products to run their businesses. See, supply chain issues have been around for a long time. They were fighting over the price of animal fat when their future father-in-law heard them fighting and said, "Boys, quit competing and form a company." And Procter & Gamble was born. And the very first product they decided to put on the market was soap. Biggest commodity out there, soap, right? But Procter & Gamble is a brilliant company. One of their core values is listening to their customers. And they don't put a product in the marketplace without listening to their customers first. So before they ever put soap on the marketplace, they went out and they asked customers, "What do you like about soap? What do you not like about soap?" Looking for the opportunity in the marketplace. And what they learned is people loved soap, but there was a problem with soap that no competitor was filling. And that problem was people would lather up in the bathtub and the soap would fall to the bottom of the bathtub and they couldn't find it. And people told Procter & Gamble they wanted a soap that floats. Procter & Gamble took a bar of soap, shot air into it, and by the end of the 1800s, they were a $1 million company. Now, Ivory soap is white. It is shaped like a block. It comes in a blue and white package. It is as boring as a product can be, but not to the customer, because it solved the right problem. Six, seven, eight, nine. Six is build your network. It will change your life. I love that we live in a high-tech world, but at the end of the day, it is all about the connections and the relationships. It'll shortcut any problem that you have. Number seven is strengthen your team, what we've talked about incessantly. Number eight is shed fast and keep moving, which I already talked about. And nine is rinse and repeat. It's a fluid strategy that needs to be done over and over again. So that is my rapid fire on how to thrive in uncertainty.
Wow. Life changed in 7 minutes or less. Here we go.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. Well, Spencer, any final questions for Meredith before we put a bow on this?
Yes, but I'm going to restrain because I'm just, I don't want to over, tax our welcome here. So thank you so much, Meredith, for your insights, your generosity, your time. I loved having you. So Christian, you wrap us up, brother.
Yeah. My final question to you, Meredith, is, well, how do people find you so that you can help them solve their problem?
Yeah, I tell you, I'm on a mission. I'm on a movement. If I can just help a part of the world start to see uncertainty as opportunity, I will be so happy. You can find me at my website, which is just simply valuespeaker.com, just the words valuespeaker.com. I tend to live on LinkedIn more than any other social media channel. And I am a big believer, if you build your network, it will change your life. If you reach out and connect with me, I will reach out and connect with you.
All right, fantastic. So listeners, viewers, please go there. Spencer, you've been helping teams becoming and leaders develop high-performing teams for decades. What's the best way for people to connect with you?
Connect with me on LinkedIn. Just message me there. And what and about you, Christian? No,
LinkedIn will do it. LinkedIn, you know, everybody's there. I'm there too. So yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. Meredith, it was a pleasure and honor to have you join us for an hour of scintillating conversation. It was super educational and inspiring. I really appreciate it. Listeners and viewers, thank you for joining us as well. Please like and subscribe to our podcast. We'll catch you again soon. Thank you so much.